One of the things I love about putting this program together every week is I get to meet and talk to some really fascinating people who are way smarter than I am. Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll reintroduce you to a traveling school evaluator and the director of the Mississippi Blues Trail.
The blues is life.
We'll also spend an academic minute with your brain on music. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Nancy Brigham has been going to school for a long time, going to many schools. She's been active in education research, observation, and evaluation for over 30 years. She has put together the thousands of interviews, hundreds of classroom observations, and firsthand experience in failing and thriving schools in her book called A Fragile Enterprise, Yesterday's Schools and Tomorrow's Students. I spoke to Nancy Brigham about her career and why it was time to put her experience down on paper.
I spent 35 years, most of it out in the field, and sometimes I was so overjoyed by what I heard and saw in classrooms that I really would like break out in goosebumps. But more often I was outraged by what I saw, and there were times I thought, I wonder if I could make a citizen's arrest because the teacher was a bully or the teacher had really retired 10 years ago but was just sitting at her desk and handing out worksheets. So the impetus for the book was the things that we never got into reports but that increasingly seemed to me to be important messages from public education.
And how did you get into this field? What made you say, hey, this is a thing I can do? Or what made other people say, this is a thing she should do?
I had a master's degree in education, and I taught 1 year, actually, in the lowest homogeneously grouped third grade in Rock Island, Illinois. And my kids needed so much, and I couldn't provide it all. And then I had a couple of children, and I stayed home a while, and then a friend introduced me to the world of education research at Apt Associates in Cambridge, and realizing that I could be involved in something bigger than one classroom, that we would somehow speak truth to power as we did evaluations of Title I, of vocational education, of Head Start. And when you speak truth to power, power is listening. It was also an impetus to write the book because we made so many recommendations over the years. And by the time that the evaluation has ended, the political winds have shifted in Washington and nobody is interested in what we started out to do.
When you go into a school and you are assigned to this teacher and you sit in their classroom, obviously you're kind of the elephant in the room. Do you think you're actually seeing what that teacher is really doing on a day-to-day basis?
That's such a good question, because for many years I went in and did observations for a single class period because the project was targeted to reading or math. And very often the teachers opted, knowing that we were coming, opted to do something that looked good but didn't involve a lot of one-on-one teaching or instruction. They would have the kids writing a composition or watching a video. And so I often felt I was getting what the teacher wanted to show me. But then on a project that had to do with different instructional remediation programs, we started shadowing students. And when you shadow a student, you are with that student all day, except that I would never go to lunch or gym. But you follow that student through the day. In elementary school, you're there with one teacher often. In middle and high school, you just go from one class to another. And as I've used shadowing in every project I've headed up, you are sometimes following the same student for 3 days, say in the fall and the spring, over 3 years. And that way, you really see what goes on in the classroom. No teacher could maintain any kind of front over that amount of time. You know, some kids go through a whole school day and no adult ever speaks to them. If they don't volunteer and keep their heads down, they slip through the day, kind of pretty much overlooked.
Some of the students you talk about in the book, you could see the different levels of engagement as they went from class to class. That must say more about the teachers than the student, doesn't it?
Isn't that wonderful that, on the one hand, that some teachers have the gift of bringing out students, but because teachers don't communicate with each other much, one teacher knows the student as, well, the words they use, you know, lazy. Sometimes they will say, you know, no parent involvement here, parents don't care. And then you see that same student, when their intellect is lighted up and engaged, can learn so much. And yes, it's the teacher stupid.
Funny you mentioned family involvement. You do have a section that talks about how some schools don't want the family involved, even though they say they do.
Oh, yeah. There's never a school that will say, we don't want families involved here. They always say they want families involved, but generally they want to control it and keep it away from the essence of schooling. They want, they want Cinco de Mayo and they want fundraisers by parents who are willing to do that. It always bothered me to see a fundraiser being run by a school where nobody had any money, bake sale, why are we running bake sales when the parents are, most of them, living on government assistance? Why are we needing that to support the school? The best example of family involvement is with students with disabilities, where the family has to be involved in developing the individual education plan. But even then, many schools keep them at arm's length. And really, it's a pro forma involvement. And the schools that we studied that really involved parents, that really made them partners, those schools not only did well academically with students with disabilities, it seemed the whole school thrived when they really began to involve not just the parents of kids with disabilities, but to welcome family involvement. That's such a huge thing, and we pay lip service to it so much.
You also talk about schools where they come up with an IEP for a student, but no one actually ever reads it or follows it.
Isn't that amazing? Mm. It was a long time before I found that out. I was following students in a school in, well, it doesn't matter where. And it was a parent who first told me, oh, no, the teachers don't read the IEPs. And I thought, well, she's just, you know, one of those bitter parents that you run into. So I added a question to my interview protocol about what you learn from the IEP. And one teacher said, I have 26 students and 14 of them are on IEPs. Do you really think I'm going to read all those? I mean, and another teacher who said, well, if I read the IEP, I'll begin treating the student differently. Well, of course you will. That was the general idea of it. So I had to bite my lip a lot, you know, or bite my tongue, I guess. It's the frustration. There's a lot of frustration that comes through in the book.
One thing that does come through in the book, though, is you seem to have a special place in your heart for special education teachers, at least a lot of them.
Yes, I do. I've often felt so calm and relaxed in a resource room where a teacher who has been well-trained to deal with the disabilities that students have and forms relationships with them, because, of course, she's likely to see them or he's likely to see them more one-on-one or maybe three kids at a time. It's constructive. It's seeing teachers do something that really seems amazing to me, that they will be so patient and go on and on and on about what the kids really need to learn and they're not learning. And of course, teachers who have special education students all day, they get a different kind of affirmation of their work, but I think it comes very much from both the students and the families.
Still to come, our conversation with Nancy Brigham continues with a look at some of the people whose stories stood out. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and we're going over some of the people we met during 2019, including Nancy Brigham, an education researcher and evaluator who has written a book about her career and observations about American schools called A Fragile Enterprise: Yesterday's Schools and Today's Students. One of the students she talks about was a special education student she called Serena. Serena lived in a group home and almost never spoke in class, but little by little began to show some progress. Then one of her parents came back into her life and moved her away from the school.
I almost cry when I think about her. You can't do the kind of close-up work that we do with teachers and students and stay completely uninvolved. You can continue to be objective in the work you do, but your heart really reaches out to the kids, the parents, teachers. And this child, she was so vulnerable, and there was no way that the school, as much as they had done for her, there was no way that the school could override the parents' right to take her, and God knows where she is now. I wish I did know. I know the teachers tried to find her, but couldn't.
There's one parent you talked about. You called her Carol. Of course, none of the names are real here. Her name was Carol, and she was fighting for special education for her student, and she walked into a dream school.
Yes, that was a school where we followed kids for 3 years and did focus group with their parents twice a year and got to hear what battles they had fought. And this particular parent had come kind of armed for combat, because she had had so little success with a previous school. So when she walked into a school that really treasured the special education students, and where in fact the special education teachers were the school leaders, you often find a leadership group of teachers in the schools, not often the special education teachers. So this was a school that we've selected as a national model for serving students with disabilities.
After all this time and seeing all these schools around the country, I have two questions. One, is local control always a good idea? And the other one is, are you hopeful for the future?
Well, those are two good questions. Is local control always a good idea? No. I would say no. Local control depends on the quality of the people who are doing the controlling. Over the many years, found that the federal government has actually been a good friend to students in need, has sponsored the programs that help to overcome the gaps in their education process and also to create policies that help to level the playing field. I think education needs to be neither locally controlled nor state controlled nor federally controlled, but an amalgam of those because each has something to offer. I think, you know, programs like No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, they're good programs. They were a good program. They just can't always overcome the inertia that happens at the local level.
Are you hopeful for the future?
Well, not as the future is envisioned by the current administration. School choice, as it's being pushed, is a really bad way to go in that we'll end up with two school systems. And I keep thinking about if the students whose families have get up and go to the nearest charter school or to a private school or a religious school, who are the kids who are left and how well can we serve them? And are we just going to say that we'll write off some number of kids? If kids could be treated, you know, as the treasures that they really are, if that's the way they approached it in Washington and in the local level, then I'd be more optimistic. I'm not as optimistic as I'd like to be right now.
You do provide solutions, however, in the book. See, if you were in charge, what would you do?
At what level am I in charge?
I'm going to make you the queen for a day.
Oh, dear, I'd hardly know where to start. There's so much research and so little research into practice about leadership at the local level. Principles are tremendously important, and I would start looking at, there are three qualities that I think a principal needs to have. Doesn't need to have them all himself or herself, but in that leadership team, you need a visionary, someone who can draw the teachers into a vision of a better school and better outcomes and happier kids and teachers. And you need someone who is adept at politics so they can deal with authority, most likely at the superintendent and school board level. And finally, you need someone who can run day-to-day operations so that the good visions don't get lost in the implementation. So I would do, of course, because I'm a researcher, I would do a lot more research on that. And then I would, if I'm really queen for a day, I'd put more funding into drawing families more closely into the school and in creating more schools that are the village that we're kind of missing. The village takes a village to raise a child, I truly believe. There are a lot of neighborhoods and urban areas in particular where there is no village, and the school really needs to take on that role, which means I'm going to fund more social workers, I'm going to fund a variety of before and after school activities, and I'm going to focus my professional development for teachers on more than instructional practice, although God knows they need more of that too. So in my position as queen for a day, I would start at the local level, and then I would make every single senator and representative shadow a student for 3 days.
And Nancy Brigham had one more point to make, and that was about the subtitle of the book, Yesterday's Schools and Tomorrow's Students. She says the structure of the school day is still rooted in the past.
You know, the schools haven't caught up. They haven't caught up in what families are like these days. The school schedule, most schools still make the assumption that mom is there in the morning to get the kids off to school, and she's there at 3:30 to welcome the student home. It doesn't work that way. And in many playtimes, the kids don't see their parents until later in the day, and they're left in the care of older siblings or neighbors. That's dangerous. And if your grandfather walked into many classrooms, he would be absolutely comfortable there because the explosion of technology is slow to reach the classroom, and it can offer so much. So that's, I guess, the message about the yesterday's schools. If we could just make the schools ready for the students instead of focusing on making the students ready for the school.
Nancy Brigham owns and manages Nancy Brigham Associates, an education research and evaluation firm. The name of her book is A Fragile Enterprise, Yesterday's Schools and Tomorrow's Students. In Mississippi, they take the blues seriously. So about 15 years ago, the Mississippi Blues Trail was established to educate people about the state's role in creating this very American form of music. Educational blues trail markers are set up in locations throughout Mississippi and other states commemorating people, locations, and events that help create the blues. Those subjects are then vetted and researched by blues historians, and only after that process is complete can a commemorative blues trail marker be set up. Kamal King is the bureau manager for Visit Mississippi and the director of the Mississippi Blues Trail. I asked him how this trail got started.
The Blues Trail got started actually about 12 years ago. In 2003, the Mississippi Blues Commission was created and brought together by Governor Haley Bryant, and they were tasked with bringing together and installing the Mississippi Blues Trail markers and coming up with a body that would actually vet and research blues artists and aficionados and venues and radio stations and sites and birthplaces and grave sites, all to commemorate the men and women and people and places that were paramount to the Mississippi blues sound catapulting throughout the United States and spreading throughout the South and the Chitlin Circuit, and then moving on to national recognition and, of course, what is matriculating into international recognition. And so these markers are historical markers that are based in Mississippi and throughout many other states and several other countries that are just important people, things, venues, railroad stations, radio stations, record labels that were center stones in making Mississippi and the Mississippi sound, and not only just the Mississippi sound, just the genre of blues period really just catapulted into the stratosphere.
And Mississippi does take ownership of the blues, doesn't it?
Most certainly. We are coined the birthplace of America's music, and we definitely boast to be the birthplace of the blues. We have many other sister cities and states that we work with and that, you know, we are very well aware that are, you know, very strong in the blues genre. But we definitely own the center of the blues, the heartbeat of it, the traditional blues that sprouted from gospel, that spread from the plantations and the sharecropper houses and the juke joints all the way throughout the rest of the world. The genesis came from Mississippi.
Now, if I take a look at the map of the blues markers, they are concentrated in Mississippi, but you've got a few in the other places. How has that been expanding throughout the country and the world, really?
Oh, it is going excellent. We're very proud that the Mississippi Blues Trail is the most noted and one of the most popular blues trails in the world. And so we have blues trail markers in other countries. By and large, most of them are based in Mississippi, but from Louisiana to California to Arkansas, you know, all the way to the eastern seaboard, we have blues trail markers because these places were part of the web and the infrastructure that really helped move the genre along, and where other states and other cities and other cultures coalesced with the Mississippi culture and took the music to another level. And had it not been for the relationships with other states and the railroad stations in other states and the communities in other states that welcomed the Mississippi artists and helped them grow outside of their traditional areas, then the growth of Mississippi blues and the blues genre period would have been stunted.
The one question I want to ask, and there's really no answer to this, but what are the blues?
The blues is life. You know, it is the ups and downs of life. And, you know, because it's called the blues and because, you know, people, you know, think of it as kind of the music of the downtrodden, or rather the nucleus of where it came from was the music of the downtrodden. And speaking of the hard times, that was only a part of it. Blues is really the I want to say the genre of life. It talks about the ups, the downs, the situations that men and women would be embarrassed of, the situations that we go through that in the shadows that no one really wants to talk about, the triumphs of our world in small factions and big factions. The blues is the organic, earthly demonstration of what life is. It is, whether it's slow or it's fast, and whether it's contemporary or it's traditional, it is really just the original storytelling of how life really is for the person behind the mic.
Kamal King is the Bureau Manager for Visit Mississippi and the director of the Mississippi Blues Trail. It could be blues or folk or rock, even punk country. Music may be the language of your brain. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Does your brain speak in music? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Dan Lloyd, professor of philosophy, discusses how repetition is shared between the language of music and our brains.
Analogies are tricky when it comes to the brain. The brain is like a biological computer. Not a bad analogy to start with, since what we do with brains is not altogether unlike what we do with computers. This leads to the next question. Computers come with programming languages, so what language encodes the brain's many programs? Is it like Java or Python or maybe English or Chinese? The tricky part is that the language analogy leads us to overlook the many ways brain processing is not like language at all. For example, the stream of perceptual experience involves a great deal of repetition. Think of how your glances of the scene around you keep returning to the same points, checking for changes and orienting new information to the framework of the old. Memory, too. How much of what passes through the mind is repetition and rehearsal, both of what happened and what you expect to happen over seconds, minutes, and days? The languages we speak and use to program our computers are not nearly so loopy. But there is something very familiar to us all that shares in the repetitivity of thought, and that is music. Maybe the basic operations of the brain are really like musical improvisations and performances, with all the repetition that is typical of music at the level of notes, motifs, phrases, refrains, themes, and variations. In my research, I explore this outlandish idea that we should turn to music for our best-fit description of brain processing. Taking off from brain imaging data, those orange blobs we know from magazine articles about the brain, I ask whether we can apply notions of scale, harmony, rhythm, and so on. In short, I'm looking into the possibility that at the neural level, each of us is a symphony.
That was Daniel Lloyd of Trinity College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time as we kick off another year of the Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.